So it's all here. The story of our time with the Barcall.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson upon the dedication of his presidential library in 1971. Since then, the library has played host to the biggest names and best minds of our day, who have helped to tell the story of our times through candid, revealing conversations with the Barkoff. This podcast delivers them straight to you. Welcome to With the Barkoff. I'm Mark Updegrove. Our guest, Melody Barnes, served as director of the White House Domestic Policy Council under President Barack Obama and is the host of the podcast LBJ and the Great Society. Currently, she's a professor at the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs and the co-director of the university's Democracy Initiative. Well, Melody Barnes, welcome to With the Barkoff. We're delighted to have you here today.
It is my pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
We talked to you at a very eventful time in our history.
Indeed.
And you've written recently, as democracy declines around the world, a global contagion lays bare chronic conditions that have gone untreated for generations. And at home, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery force us once again to confront our culture and its laws, policies, and practices. So let me start off with the latter part of that statement. Mm-hmm. It seems like this is a moment in our history that can become an inflection point. It already has to a certain extent. Do you think this will be an impassioned moment that leads to some change, or will become a sustained movement that leads to greater reform?
I hope for the latter, and I'm concerned it may just be the former. And that concern is based in history. This isn't our first rodeo on these kinds of issues. In fact, we as a nation have had hundreds and hundreds of years of grappling with these issues. We have had uprisings and moments of resistance. We have fought a civil war. We have dealt with issues of lynching. Mamie Till opened her son Emmett Till's casket so that the nation could, quote, see what they've done to my boy, which helped to prompt the civil rights movement. Rosa Parks is said to have commented that that's what one of the things that led her in her work as a civil rights leader, not to get up out of that seat. All that to say, we've been here before, and while important things have been done, we haven't been able to sustain it to get to the root of the problem. And I think, quite frankly, it is our fragility as a nation and the lack of desire in some cases, the fear of the discomfort with dealing with issues of race and ethnicity that have not allowed us to sit with them, to study them, to acknowledge them, to become proximate to them, and to not only change the laws, but also to do the hard work of changing hearts as well as minds in our communities. So that's where my concern comes from. At the same time, I live just steps away from the Robert E. Lee statue in Richmond, Virginia. And my husband and I have been eyewitnesses to the protests. While social distancing, stood in the street and prayed with the protesters as they prayed and cheered and clapped when people spoke of the opportunity to eradicate injustice from our own community, as it is also symbolized in those statues. And so I've seen the passion that sits there and the determination to keep this movement going and not just let it be a brief moment. And that's what keeps me hopeful.
Let me go to the first part of your statement, which is about democracy internationally. And I don't want to talk about internationally. I want to talk about here in America. What is the state of American democracy in 2020?
Well, we know, and this isn't just a feeling, but we know from the data, for example, Freedom House does an important study every year that they put out in March. And this past March, when they did their report and they announced it, not only did they show significant decline globally, but they showed that the United States is also sliding backwards. That the kinds of concerns that I've heard people talk about at the water cooler and at kitchen tables and around conference room tables are things that they are seeing in as they collect evidence to show that the United States is challenged in its democracy. Threats to the press, threats to voting rights, challenges to the independence of the judiciary. That list goes on and on. We have much to be concerned about when we look at American democracy right now.
We'll talk about LBJ in a moment. Without question, his most trying year in the presidency was 1968. And there have been comparisons between 2020 and 1968, which LBJ called the nightmare year and really shook this country to its core. How would you compare the two, 2020 to 1968, another transformational year in American history?
Yeah, absolutely. In addition to working on my own podcast this past year, I had the opportunity to teach a class, to co-teach a class on the Great Society this year and discuss this with our students. I co-taught it with a professor who's an expert on social movements. His name is Sid Milkus. And the comparisons are striking. I mean, as I'm watching this unfold, I wish that we were still in class so we could engage the students on this. Certainly, watching the size and the intensity of the protests, certainly watching what's happening in cities around the country, this isn't isolated, but these really are movements and the coordination in the best possible sense of the word and the attention to key issues, top of the list. And when you look at the work that was done at that point in time, I mean, after Johnson commissioned the Kerner report, and you read that report, the same issues that were at the top of the list then are the issues that are at the top of the list now. Issues of unemployment and underemployment, issues of police brutality, issues of housing. Those are the top three issues then. I think if you polled people and talked to people now, they would list those at the top of their list right now. So both the focus and the intensity of these movements, and movements in large part that are led by young people, and also the issues that have people focused and in the streets, even at a moment where it may challenge their health to do so.
Melody, for young people in particular, what can they learn from the year 1968?
I'm not sure if young people today in the streets are in any way students of 1968. For the students I was teaching classroom, I think it was new ground for them. But there are some fascinating lessons. One, they used both the power of protest along with the power of the pen. They were writing and making very specific demands. They were critiquing society, but also are starting to articulate what they wanted from a new society. They were also using the power of protest to drive attention, to bring attention to their cause, to their plight, to their concerns, while they were simultaneously also working with lawmakers at that point. So you've got John Lewis and Martin Luther King, and Unita Blackwell and others who were in the streets protesting and boycotting. But you also have Martin Luther King talking to Lyndon Johnson and being very specific about what he wants. And I think it's fascinating, even as they were working together, not necessarily buddies, but working together, to accomplish things like the Civil Rights of 64 or the Voting Rights Act of 65, when Johnson said to King, look, you know, I'm trying to get a lot of things done. I'm trying to move Medicare, and this is really going to help you. Just give me a moment before we get this voting rights thing up and going. Not opposing it, but just a matter of timing. And King said, no. And they went back to the streets. And that also forced a legislative and a policy adjustment in Washington. So the ability to use both sets of tools at the same time, I think is very powerful and a very important language. I think the other thing, though, to remember is even as laws were changing, when Dr. King, for example, gets near the end of his life, he's also talking about the relationship between love and power. Mm. And those two things have to move together. And I think it is important when we go and we are working in community to recognize the importance of our proximity to one another, that we are living in the same community and in adjacent or the same neighborhoods. How do we also encourage a change of heart and a change of spirit that fundamentally sits at the root of all of this? The ability to recognize the humanity in that person who is asking the policeman to get off the neck of George Floyd.
But there was a symbiotic relationship between Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King. They needed each other, and they knew Correct. That they needed each other. Mm-hmm. They pushed each other. What do you do when you have a president who's resistant to change?
I think in this instance, the importance of this movement to draw attention to these critical and chronic long-standing issues, to force Americans that didn't want to look at this and recognize that we have a leader who's hostile to the kind of change that the protesters are talking about, and quite frankly, hostile to the protesters themselves, so that people exercise the power of the ballot in November is critical. When you don't like the leadership, you have to change the leadership. Mm. And that is also the beauty of American democracy. It is a constitutional republic. We get to decide, we get to choose. And that can be the power of this movement as well.
Let me go back to your wonderful podcast, LBJ and the Great Society. You say in the podcast, Melody, 50 years later, the cloud of Vietnam still casts a long shadow over the Johnson presidency. But here's the thing. Before he lost his way in Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson altered the American political landscape more profoundly and with more enduring consequences than any president since Franklin Roosevelt. How did LBJ change our country?
This period, the Great Society, the period of the Johnson presidency, was absolutely transformative. And I think because of the cloud, it has been understudied, and there's a discomfort with that period. But Lyndon Johnson put it all on the line, and he knew what he was doing, but he did it to breathe life into democratic aspirations and to the promise of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, which, as critical as they were when they were passed, in many ways didn't have any bite to them. He gave them life. He brought the attention of the country and the world in partnership, as you were just saying, in partnership with the civil rights movement, and he credited them for that. But he brought the attention of the world to what had been happening in the United States for hundreds of years and said, we're going to change this. And what I think few people understand is that Lyndon Johnson, though Master of the Senate, though President of the United States, though someone who operated with deep knowledge of the federal level of our government, understood the importance of community, that there was an entire component of what he was doing that focused on what needed to happen deep in communities and to build the strength and the capacity locally to support what needed to happen at a national level. And by supporting and strengthening those organizations, there was an architecture that was put in place for people of color, for low-income people to fight for, to articulate their needs, their desires, what they wanted from their elected representatives. And that is an enormously powerful thing, because that says, I believe in and I trust that you know, Mrs. Smith, Mr. Jones, understand your needs, and armed with the right to vote and your knowledge of your own circumstances, that you can shape your own destiny and your own future. And so I think that that is another important part of what Lyndon Johnson did, in addition to the great laws. And the laws, if people really look, well, I think some people have, and it scares them. For me, I look at the list of laws that cover every aspect of American life, from issues of poverty to healthcare, to the arts, to education, to the environment, and recognize that he continued to reshape the relationship between citizens and their federal government, started by FDR, but certainly doubled down on it by Lyndon Johnson.
So you referenced the cloud that has shrouded Lyndon Johnson's legacy, which is certainly Vietnam. And there are a lot of preconceptions and misconceptions that people have about Lyndon Johnson. What do you think the biggest misconception about LBJ is?
Well, when people think that he did things that he didn't do, I have been privy to conversations or overheard snippets of conversations and the problems that sit in public housing, they blame him for. He did not start public housing, which is important. I'm not saying that, but that started in the 1940s and with urban renewal. So there are a lot of misconceptions about what Lyndon Johnson did and didn't do. And at the same time, they credit other presidents. For example, President Kennedy gets a lot of credit for things that Lyndon Johnson actually did do. So I think because the period was relatively short, because he did not run for re-election, and because of the cloud of Vietnam, that there isn't an in-depth knowledge of all that got packed into those 5 years of his administration.
What do you think the most underappreciated aspect of his legacy is?
People understand, I believe, that he was a masterful legislator and understood Washington. I don't believe that people understood the relationship that he had with the movements that deserve significant credit for what happened during that period, that there really was a symbiotic give and take relationship, and that he understood their power, encouraged it, was sometimes pushed by it, but again, credited it. I mean, and including at signing ceremonies for major pieces of legislation. So I think that that is one of the most significant things about him. And also, I think, given who he was and where he came from, the complexity of this man who, you know, came from Texas and at the same time believed that the years that he taught Mexican children in Cotulla, Texas was a transformative moment in his life, got to Congress and had a record that aligned with the segregationist caucus of the South, and then started to pivot in by the late 50s, and threw himself into the transformation of this country at a moment when he knew the political costs were going to be so high. So you have someone who is a political animal, who was also willing to put that, to sacrifice that for what he believed was absolutely necessary to transform and to move the country forward.
Where does Lyndon Johnson belong in the pantheon of presidents?
I think he is one of the most significant and transformative presidents that we have had. He And because of what he did, because of the laws that were passed, on a personal level, and I think many other people would need to say this as well, on a personal level, my life would not look the way that it does right now, but for what Lyndon Johnson did, what he challenged the nation to do, and the laws that he signed. I was born the year the Civil Rights Act of 64 was signed. And when I think about that and the Voting Rights Act and everything else, I could not have been the director of the Domestic Policy Council in the White House working for the first African-American president, but for what happened during the period of the Great Society.
You say in the podcast, working for Barack Obama in the White House, as you did as domestic policy advisor, I saw just how difficult it is with all the powers of the presidency to move the needle on anything of real importance. And yet, Lyndon Johnson did move the needle over on a scale that today seems unimaginable. Given the divisions that President Obama faced and the hyperpartisanship that seems to be a chronic condition in Washington, was Barack Obama able to move the needle to the extent that LBJ did?
Absolutely. I think that what President Obama did is underappreciated. And those listening would say, well, of course she would say that. She worked for him. But you can ignore me and just go and look at the data. And with a Congress, but for those first couple of years, that was often adversarial to his agenda, the president not only, President Obama not only passed significant pieces of legislation, the Affordable Care Act, the largest reform of higher education since Lyndon Johnson passed the Higher Education Act, significant K-12 transformation, significant work on the environment, Dodd-Frank dealing with the financial services industry. I could go on and on and on. He was able to do that with a Congress that was often hostile and at numbers that I think people would be startled by. So I believe that next to Johnson in sheer number and also magnitude and FDR, President Obama's legacy, what he was able to accomplish in 8 years will stand the test of time.
And yet he was criticized for not rolling up his sleeves and engaging with Congress in the same manner that LBJ did. Is that a fair criticism?
Yeah, well, first of all, he did roll up his sleeves and he did engage. One of my colleagues, Phil Schalero, who was the head of legislative affairs the first couple of years and then was a counselor to the president for another year or so during the administration, and I have talked about this, and Phil will talk about the calls and the meetings and, you know, the impassioned work that the president did on a personal level to move an agenda. At the same time, Barack Obama and Lyndon Johnson are two different personalities. Lyndon Johnson had worked for decades in Washington, and by the time that he became president of the United States, he had long-standing relationships because of that, that were important. And stylistically, he was just different. I mean, the way he used his sheer physical size, you know, the get in your face, the jabbing finger in your chest, that isn't who Barack Obama is. But he all and nor was that the time that Barack Obama was president. I mean, you try to do that, and that's on social media and trending in a few seconds. At the same time, he used his powerful oratorical skills. He used the relationships that he had built, and he used the fact that the American people were responding to him, responsive to him, to try and move the agenda along. And he also used executive authority and executive orders to try and move things when recalcitrants would not allow for progress. So he used the tools that he had to in a very, very different time. And quite frankly, in a time when government is fractured and relationships in Washington are fractured in such a way that heightened polarization prevents almost anything from getting done.
What was it like to work with the 44th president?
It was the honor of a lifetime. Anytime, if you truly believe in public service, anytime you get to get up every day and to walk through those gates and past people who are tourists or protesting or whatever they are doing, and walk into the West Wing of the White House and try to move the agenda forward for the American people, and to do so for someone of the integrity, of the decency, the intelligence of President Obama, it is a great, great honor. It is hard. I tell people that it's like a day at the beach, and by that I mean this: when you wander into the waves and you get knocked down, and you know you stand up, and by the time you've got the salt water out of your eyes and the sand out of your bathing suit, another wave comes and hits you again. It feels like that every single day, one wave after another.
So you're saying it was no day at the beach,
is exactly. I mean. but it was an honor, and I would not change or trade those 3 years.
You had worked for Ted Kennedy prior to working for Barack Obama, but you had not seen the presidency up close. What is the central impression that you have about the presidency, having had that experience with Barack Obama?
When I watch people raise their hand and say, "I want to run for president," in the back of my mind, I think, "Really? It's hard." It is harder than anyone can imagine, and I have seen it up close, and I still know that I don't know how difficult it is. The kinds of decisions that you have to make every hour of every single day. A good friend of mine, she was the deputy chief of staff for policy, and we worked together for several years in the White House, and she used to say, by the time decisions get to us, I mean, even that's before they get to the president, by the time they get to us, all the good options are gone. Mm. And what you're left with is trying to make the best out of bad, difficult choices because of the difficulty of the circumstances. So it's extremely hard. And at the same time, what I will never forget is the night that healthcare was passed. And it was a warm March evening, warmer than normal. And after it passed, the president invited us to the residence to celebrate. And it was probably 1 or 2 in the morning. And we were standing on the Truman balcony. And he said, "This is better than election night, because this is why we came here." Hmm. And that is also what I think about the presidency. As difficult as it is, when you are able to do things that you truly believe are for the good of millions and millions and millions of Americans, it is, if you believe in public service, it's a dream. It is a dream come true.
You talked about the burden that you saw the president shepherd as chief executive of this country. And yet he wore it with such grace. I think, you know, perhaps the signature moment of his presidency when he sang in Charleston, mm-hmm. South Carolina, "Amazing Grace." And it was ironic to me because that's so characterized his presidency, the amazing grace with which he held the burden of the presidency. Where did that come from? Where does that come from? That equanimity, that grace that he showed so manifestly?
It comes from empathy and compassion. It comes from a deep sense of a belief in the humanity of others. And not only getting up to do the work, to read the materials, to do all the things that his staff would ask him to do. But it comes from the place that hopefully drives a person to run for president or a person to be a part of public life, which is the fact that you believe that those individuals are just like you. They want the same things that you want for your children, for the people that you love, and even when you disagree, that there is a shared sense of humanity. And if you can get up and fight for them every single day, that you can move us closer to achieving those goals that every American holds for him or herself, themselves, and for their families. I think that's where it comes from.
We talked about President Johnson and his legacy and where he stands in the pantheon of presidents. Where do you think Barack Obama's place among his presidential peers will be?
I think it will be significant for several reasons. One, I think, is the obvious, but it's for me, it is not the only. I mean, because he was the first African-American president, that will always be an important marker in American life. And quite frankly, because of the backlash to that, that will always be an important moment of inflection for the United States. But more importantly than that, he was able to do significant things as a matter of policy, and to continue to shape the presidency in a way that historians will and political scientists and others will continue to study. I mean, this issue of presidential power and authority and how it's used, the role and posture of the president on the global stage and the United States on the global stage. This was an important time, an important period in those ways. And this presidency will be studied not just because of what happened domestically, but because it was an important moment. And I think we see and feel that now for the way that America is viewed internationally and the role of American power and diplomatic power, economic power in a globalized world will also be important.
The podcast is LBJ and the Great Society, and our guest is Melody Barnes. Melody, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
My thanks to Melody Barnes, to our sponsors, the Moody Foundation and St. David's Healthcare, and of course to you for joining us. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Mark Updegrove. See you next time.